Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to Be Bold America. I'm your host, Jill Cody. Be Bold America is a live bi-weekly talk show for those who are motivated to step out with the bold actions necessary to reunite this country, fight for our democracy, and learn what they can keep doing, stop doing, and start doing to return to our democratic republic. Be sure to vote and make a plan. Our future depends on it. Our program today is The Election Whisperer. It has been said many times that this is the most consequential election of our country's history. I believe that is true. With the current person in the Oval Office clearly being an autocrat, if he is reelected, we will lose what is left of our democracy and become just another autocracy in the world. We no longer will be that beacon on a hill. We have big things to do. Our special guest today is Dr. Rachel Bitticoffer. Rachel Bitticoffer is a nationally recognized election forecaster and pro-democracy researcher. She's the author of the book, The Unprecedented 2016 Presidential Election, and she is editor of The Cycle, to be found at thecycle.news. As it says on The Cycle's website, Rachel is a forecaster, election analyst, pollster, and all-around data girl, and she brings that all-around data girl talent to host the excellent podcast, The Election Whisperer. Rachel's work appears in a variety of the nation's leading media outlets, including The New York Times, The Washington Post, Politico, The Guardian, and she's been seen on MSNBC and Real Time with Bill Maher. In addition, she has been a guest on several prominent podcasts, including Rumble with Michael Moore and the Michael Steele podcast, just to name a few. She describes her weekly podcast, The Election Whisperer, as election nerd Disneyland for wonks with a good sense of humor. Rachel, welcome to Be Bold America. It's such a pleasure to have you on the program today.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and hopefully my son will be a little bit quieter there in the background.
That's quite all right. I've been looking forward to speaking with you, you know, for so long, and thank you for being here today. And before we start talking about your forecast for the 2020 presidential election, what drew you to become an election forecaster, pro-democracy research, and all-around data girl? How did this unique profession become a passion?
Yeah, I don't know that, you know, it's actually a profession, I suppose. I guess that you could call it a profession, right? I'm actually totally serendipity in terms of the election forecasting bit. I didn't aim to do that, though I guess I would be lying to say I hadn't hoped when I started off on this long journey many, many, many years ago now. I actually ironically did want to be somebody that would, you know, come on to radio shows and be on TV talking and analyzing politics. So when I, you know, enrolled in college, I was, you know, with that goal in mind. I actually had that goal in mind, and that was just to start off as my undergraduate degree. I was 24, and the Iraq War was raging, and I remember thinking, you know, how can so many smart people be so dumb? And so I figured, you know, I'm going to go to college and try to figure out, if they can be that dumb, I mean, maybe I should try my hand, right? So I figured out pretty early into my collegiate career that I wanted to get an advanced degree. I wasn't sure if it would be law or a PhD in poli-sci, to be a professor, but I didn't think the odds that were very good that I would ever make it to, you know, the green room of MSNBC or, you know, Bill Maher's show, though those were things that I aspired to do. And then I had kind of given up hope on that and just, you know, had, you know, decided I'd be a professor and I'd teach and I'd do research. But then the 2016 election happened, and I was starting to realize that I had pretty unusual, like, takes, I guess, compared to, like, the establishment take on the election. And I was frustrated a little bit by that, too. It was frustrating to me that, you know, the way that people would describe what happened in that election, like, did not match the data very well. Like, it was, you would talk about, like, you know, they talk about, like, Trump kind of sweeping into the Midwest on this, like, you know, kind of like a populist revolt, right? And like he won over the white working class voters, and you know, who could have seen it coming? And da da da. You know what I mean? Like, and it was like, no, that's like not what happened at all. Like white working class voters have been de-aligning from Democrats for you know, decades now, you know, realigning to the Republican Party. So like the fact that the Republican candidate won them is not at all surprising. What was surprising was that Democrats like kind of shot themselves in that election by not showing up when they could have.
That's correct.
And you know, and voting third party, you know, and complacency basically, right? And, you know, and yet, you know, on the TV shows and on, you know, I guess what people would call like the election websites, you know, it was still, oh, white working class, let's go talk to them, you know, like you're so aggrieved, you know. And, you know, I remember telling my students, you know, I mean, I was relying on the same data you guys were, right? You know, the models and stuff. And I would tell my students, oh, no, you know, she's going to win. But boy, I'm nervous about how angry the Bernie people seem, especially after the convention, you know. And and I said, if she does lose, it's going to be because of that, of you know, just dissension basically within the party, you know. And so when the loss happened, you know, I went and looked at the data, and of course, like, it's exactly what I saw, these huge rates of third party balloting. I mean, in Wisconsin is a state that, sorry, the dogs, of course, they always get so rowdy at night.
Well, I was going to ask you, Rachel, what's your dog's name, since we'll be hearing him or her?
Yeah, so...
what's your dog's name?
My Australian Shepherd is Ginsburg, and my Sheepadoodle's name is Hamilton.
Ginsburg and Hamilton. Now, on your... Cycle website. I wanted to say it's cyclethecycle.news. That's not .com or .org, .news. It says that 15 months in, the negative partisanship model predictions for presidential race and Congress have come to pass. What has come to pass, Rachel?
That's exactly right. And it was kind of what I was segueing to before we stopped for the break, which is, you know, this idea that, you know, when Clinton lost, it was, you know, it was because the Democrats did not fully flex their demographic advantage in the electorate, right? And now, and since Trump won that night, you know, from the moment that he won that night in the Javits Center, Democrats have lost that complacency through a concept that's called negative partisanship, which is a concept in polarization research, because I'm a political scientist, and it refers to fear, right? Hate and fear, but really fear of Donald Trump, that you feel towards him, towards the Republican Party, that motivates people to vote. And we saw these huge turnout surges, you know, in Virginia, where my theory starts to get born from, and then 2018, where my first model is put out, is forward facing, and it predicts, you know, hey, you guys are really undercutting the size of this House wave. It's going to be 40 seats, not, you know, a question of whether they can take control. They're going to blow that out, and they're going to double it, basically. And so, you know, when I talk about these 15 months of 16, what we've seen come to fruition is proof of this really agitated Democratic coalition. And we're not talking just about Democrats, like the base, right? Mm-hmm. We're talking about progressives. We're talking about Black voters, Latino voters. We're talking about independents. We're not even talking about Democrats entirely. We're talking about independents that lean Democratic. And we're talking about women, really, really about women, and young people, and all these voters who were so lazy about voting in 2016, or just complacent, might have, you know, been interested in writing in a third party name, or writing in Bernie Sanders, who are now really, really, really motivated to get rid of Donald Trump and going to be showing up big time to vote. And so that's what my modeling is about, and it has predicted for a long time that the Democrats would retake the presidency. And so my forecasting work, of course, is on the website Cycle, so people can go and see that in detail, and it does the presidential stuff, but also Congress.
It does have a lot of detail. I like the site very much. And your word agitated, it just doesn't seem strong enough to me. I am way past agitated.
My favorite word is actually I borrow it from Rebecca Traceder, who wrote a book pretty early post Trump's election. It's called Good and Mad. And her word, it's two words, actually. She uses incandescent rage, and that's how I really like to think of it.
Oh, that's a great phrase.
A woman. Yeah, I think you kind of have to be a woman to understand
to
it.
But feel that one.
Incandescent rage, right? Yeah.
So what are your 2020 presidential forecast and include the Senate seats as well and maybe even Electoral College in that?
So my 2020 forecast has predicted for months and months that the Democrats would actually have a pretty easy time in the Midwest. The reason that Clinton lost the Midwest again, as I was talking about in Wisconsin, I mean, usually it is, that loss for her was less than 1 point to Trump. But what's really notable is that 7% of the vote went to either third-party candidates or to write-in. I mean, it was almost 20,000 write-in. It was like 15,000 write-in ballots.
Wow, that is a lot. 7%. Yeah. Isn't that a lot?
7%. Yes,
yeah.
It is. It's way, way more. So, like, the Nader 2000 election in Florida was, like, 1.7% of the vote, okay?
Wow.
And yet no one talks about 2016 in this term. Like, and no one talks about 2016 as the year that, you know, defection cost Clinton the election, right? They all talk about it with, like, white working class grievance politics. But it's much more, third-party stolen, defection election than 2000 ever was. Yeah, definitely. And they were all like that. All the swing states are like that. They're all less than 1 point, and they range from 3.5 to, 6 points of third-party balloting.
Wow. So what? So now it looks like the Democrats will win the presidential election. However, then we have the Electoral College.
Well, that's what we're forecasting, right? It's not concerned with the popular votes. Looking at the swing state predictions, right? So it predicts that, because that complacency factor is gone in the Midwest, that the Democrats would be in a very strong position, even before they had a nominee to re-win the Midwest. And I believe I said in that first forecast, by the time we get to the fall of 2020, the attention really will be on other states like Texas, like Florida, like Arizona. The Midwest will be so obviously bending towards the Democrats. And then beyond that, when we look at the Congress, we look at the Senate, my forecast was always very confident that Colorado, Arizona, and Maine were going to flip for the Democrats. But then it's about that four seat because Doug Jones is probably going to be, it's a hard to imagine there'll be a lot of people who will vote for Trump and then vote for Doug Jones, right? It's easier to imagine crossover voters in the Democratic Party doing that in Maryland than in Massachusetts than Republicans doing that right now, right? So Doug Jones is in a tough spot. So Democrats should need a fourth seat, and where that fourth seat should come from is probably North Carolina. But because the pandemic has added in some extra juice to, Biden's advantage, to the Democrats' advantage, we really are seeing, strong competition in Iowa, in Montana, perhaps even in Kansas and Alaska. So they have many pathways to that fourth seat to take the Senate majority.
What do you think about Lindsey Graham's seat?
Yes, that too. And this, that one is actually competitive and has a chance for him to lose. You know, it's much more competitive than the much more difficult to get McConnell seat.
Mm-hmm. And Cornyn's seat. What about that one? What do you think?
Yeah. So another notable thing about my forecast is, you know, in 2019, because, you know, the negative partisanship is the theoretical part of it, but it talks about and predicted, you know, the reason the House forecast was so accurate on the size of the wave was I was able to say, look, there's all of these suburban areas that have not yet transferred to the Democrats in this long-term realignment, because white working-class people are realigning to the Republican Party, but college-educated whites are realigning to the Democratic Party. And it's not so much like the same people who are changing and switching, though there are independents that are doing that. It's actually generational replacement. So as millennials who are now 40 are reaching their adulthood and they're moving into the suburbs, they are not Republicans like boomers and Gen X were, and Zoomers too, right? So, you know, what's happening in the suburbs is the suburbs are diversifying, and they are also, you know, generationally different. So we are seeing, you know, places where you really have a lot of change. And so Texas was a place I put a giant bullseye on in 2019, and I said, look, there are like 9 House seats there that are have these demographics of suburban areas that are going to make them prime in 2020. And that's exactly what we're seeing. And that's important for Biden and for MJ Hager, because it feeds that and the fact that the state legislature there, the state House might flip. So both of those things are really positive, because usually top ticket activity helps bottom level activity, but in the case of Texas, it's the opposite.
Well, in our next minute or so before our next break, what do you think the Gen Zs, aren't they becoming 18 now and can vote?
Yeah. They were first enfranchised in the 2016 election, the very, very first ones
okay.
of them. Like 2018, and I think like the millennial generation fully enfranchised in 2016. So yeah, Gen Z, first wave of them 2018, and then this will be their first presidential cycle.
How are they breaking? Are they following the millennial pattern?
Yes, definitely. I mean, you know, that's the thing with the Republican Party is that they have really doubled down on this, you know, white grievance, racial resentment politics. And it's, you know, very powerful in terms of moving a certain type of white voter, but it is very isolating for younger voters.
And it's you're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM. Many voices, one station. Listen worldwide online from KSQD.org homepage, or catch up on previous shows by listening to the KSQD Be Bold America webpage, or subscribe using your favorite podcast platform. I'm your host, Jill Cody. And back to Rachel. Rachel, I have another question for you. And there was a lot of shenanigans going on in Pennsylvania, and it looks like they may have stopped what they were planning to do. But aren't there about 6 key states, maybe swing states, that are just all held by Republican legislatures? And don't we need to watch them?
Oh, yes. No, I mean, anybody who can hear my voice should know that, you know, what the real problem is isn't so much the voting this year. The votes are going to be there this year. I'm really confident in that. The modeling and the data and the polling. I mean, number one, the polling was not wrong in 2016. The experts were. The polling was saying, hey, you know, nobody likes Clinton and Trump, fair or not. You know, a lot of voters saw them as equally unattractive. And like I said, that's not a fair thing for Hillary Clinton at all, because there's really a gulf of difference between those two candidates and on many, many crucial metrics before you even get to politics, right? That, you know, make it an unfair comparison. So, but it is what it is, and that's how voters saw it. And so the polls were sending a fire alarm the whole time about uncertainty. About 15% of the two-party vote share was not being explained in the polling data. And so what the narrative should have been is that, you know, with that much vote left to get decided, that, you know, anything could happen on election night. And if people had had that narrative instead of, oh, Clinton's so dominant, she's got this in the bag, who knows how people may have behaved differently, right? So, you know, keep that in mind, because in terms of this election, there can only be so much disconnect between the data and reality and what we should see, unless these data change and we start to see significantly different data. You know, at this point, we should see Biden win this election. And, you know, what we do know is that we have a president who controls the federal government and an attorney general who controls the Justice Department, who are waging open warfare on voting. The Republican Party National Committee is helping them do that. This is not a Trump thing. It's not a Bliss comment or, you know, some kind of, you know, joke. This is an actual strategic effort that's being played out on multiple stages within the Republican infrastructure. And what they are doing is they are suing, you know, Texas and Pennsylvania and Ohio and Michigan and all these states to prevent there being ballot drop-off boxes, to prevent, you know, the number of days ballots could be turned in. They're going to try to slow down the counts to keep ballots from being counted. And what they're ultimately going to do is try to win the election by keeping your votes from being counted, right? And, you know, on this end, people are doing what they can do to prevent those efforts from coming to fruition. But the fact is that the Justice Department generally has been the force that has helped step in to keep American elections, you know, being free and fair. And now it has been being weaponized against the electoral system. So it is, you know, I cannot possibly overstate the severity of that condition. So, you know, the thing that people can handle or control is the voting aspect. So do your job, vote.
Make a plan and vote. That's right.
Yeah, exactly. And try not to worry about the other parts. And no, but you should know that they're going on, and know that, you know, if you have money and bandwidth to devote to the, you know, democracy docket, which is, you know, Mark Elias's legal, you know, basically it's a team of lawyers that are fighting these things in court. You know, great, help out. If you're a lawyer, help out. But you know, the part that the public can control is the vote, right? Get you and everyone you know who can to vote, cast a ballot, and then, you know, let us worry about getting it counted.
And they're doing the voter suppression with their lawyers now, as you were saying, about trying to get removed drop boxes and things. But after the election, they have armies of lawyers, teams of lawyers for all 50 states. And what really worries me is Bill Barr has not been shown himself to be trustworthy. Yeah.
Right. They are on open warfare against this election. There is no doubt about it. Democracy is, you know, fully hanging in the balance here. So we need everyone engaged, everyone understanding the stakes and the severity of what's happening. And it's unfortunate that, you know, the Republican Party has endorsed this strategy, is engaged in a conspiracy to subvert the electoral process. But it is what it is, and the only way to stop it is to overcome it. So we're just going to have to do that, you know.
Well, and the thing with Barr too is that he can use the Justice Department to help Trump win the election by, you know, after the election, filing criminal charges of voter fraud, or use the fraud statute to charge voters of the Democratic Party or election officials with a crime. I mean, he has that kind of power. And he was also talking about, you know, to Wolf Blitzer about a foreign adversary could mail in counterfeit ballots, which is just impossible. Their mail-in ballots have barcodes to identify them and track individual ballots. And so the confusion that they are trying to create, I feel, is going to may lead to these other Republican, these states like Pennsylvania. Well, they'll say, the Republican legislators say, well, it's just too confusing. We don't know really who won. And we'll just appoint these electors, and they're for Trump.
Is that that's literally the strategy. That is their strategy. Yeah, it's not an accident. Like, that is the strategy. Like, that's literally the goal, is to try to drain the clock to prevent certification of the count, so that they can try to put forward these alternative electors. Yes.
So the Electoral College could still trigger a constitutional crisis or a disputed election.
Yeah, so, well, you know, I mean, the thing that we can control is the vote, right?
Right.
Yeah,
right.
If we pound them, like, you know, the scenarios that they can use are much easier if it's a close election.
Mm-hmm.
So we just have to pound them.
Well, this is probably a good time to tell people that there's iwillvote.com that you can go to. And California's registration deadline is October 19th, so it's 11th today. Oh. It's just got another week or so to register for the election, so please get out there.
It's not a time to be doing protest balloting or, you know, things like that, because I would just say to people who can hear my voice, if you have doubts about the differences between the Democratic and Republican Party, go look at the bills that were passed by the Democratic-controlled House, the 106th House, since 2018, and look at the legislation that they passed that's gone to McConnell's desk to die.
And just sits there.
And tell me that's not worth putting through, right? I mean, that there's not a difference between that party and the Republican Party, right? And, you know, there are many people whose lives, I mean, there are people who have died beyond the COVID people, like, who would be alive if Hillary Clinton had won the last election, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who are dead or dying, you know, people on the border in Mexico, because we have no asylum claim now. Like, you cannot come here and claim asylum. Instead, you go to this, like, basically this refugee hellhole on the Mexican border, where women are, you know, raped daily, right?
Well, and they're being forced hysterectomies too. I mean, this is just not America.
No doubt.
And the doctor doesn't have a license or isn't registered with the medical board. There's something there with the doctor who's doing these hysterectomies.
Right.
I mean, it's just beyond me.
Not a time for moral superiority is what I'm saying.
This is
a time like, you know, people and people who blissfully think that it will be fun to have a revolution. I urge you, go watch some international news from a war zone, from a society that has crumbled into chaos, because it is not pleasant. And the other side, the Republican side, is much better armed than our side. So, you know, if society degrades into that level, I guarantee you are not going to have any soy chai lattes, A, and B, our death toll is going to be much higher.
Well, moving to your pro-democracy researcher side, I think I'm very also terrified that I can list my how many things I'm terrified by, but is Marjorie Taylor Greene, you know, is very likely a QAnon candidate, is going to be in Congress.
Oh,
and
yeah.
QAnon is no longer a fringe anymore.
Yeah.
And what drives me crazy about this one is that, you know, Q is called Q Clarence Patriot, and the, you know, found on the Fortran board, and Q could be a bot for all we know. I mean, so many people following QAnon and the really despicable, you know, that Democrats are eating children and and child trafficking, and now we're going to have one in Congress. Any thoughts on?
More than one, probably.
I think
we're going to have a couple.
Oh, dear.
Oh, yes. Yeah. No, and then by 2022, we'll probably have a couple dozen.
And yet...
I doubt there's any Republicans listening to this right now, but if there is, in case there is one, That's what will happen if Donald, you know, if the MAGA Donald Trump phenomenon is not put out to pasture. That is what's coming for the Republican Party next. Okay, it, you know, like just as the Tea Party revolution swept through, soon it will be this QAnon thing, and it will go from 2 to 3 to the dozen to 100, and that, you know, that's where the Republican Party is headed. Unless good and decent Republicans, and we know that we're still out there, stand up and say no mas.
Well, at least with the Tea Party, we knew who was behind that, like the Koch brothers. But this could be a bot. It could be a Russian bot. I mean, many millions of people following somebody they've never seen or talked to that fall for really abhorrent concepts. And then believe that, and will therefore act on that against the Democrats in Congress.
Terror. Yeah. It's a domestic terror organization.
Yes.
You know? its goal? Its goal is this storm thing is, you know, their goal is, their desire is to, that Trump is going to initiate a roundup of people like me.
Mm-hmm. And me.
And you. You know what I mean?
Yes,
and there is actually a pretty good chunk of, you know, normal, average. I mean, we are in a real moment here in America. So, like, you know, it's really not time to be picky.
Well, Trump is already asking Bill Barr to arrest Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden. I mean, right now he's asking to arrest people.
Yes, yes. Like, we are on the, like, we are having our little... Like, we are very much, very much in danger of like, you know, Nazi Germany moment here in America.
Mm-hmm. We are very close. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM. I'm your host, Jill Cody. Our topic is The Election Whisperer. We're speaking with Dr. Rachel Bitticoffer, author of the book, The Unprecedented 2016 Presidential Election, and host of the podcast, The Election Whisperer. And this election season promises to be like no other. KSQD will be there reporting on the local, state, and national races and their aftermath. A trusted voice with no fake news. A breath of fresh air. That's KSQD, community radio for the rest of us and the best of us. And back to Rachel, a nationally recognized election forecaster, pro-democracy researcher, and an all-around data girl. She's the editor of The Cycle, found at thecycle.news. That's not .com or .org. That's thecycle.news, and host of the podcast, The Election Whisperer. So, Rachel, another thing that just terrified me was when Mike Lee said a democracy is not the objective.
Oh, yes. You know what they're doing? Just as they did with the Supreme Court reversal, right? So, like, they knew that there was going to be some chunk of the Republican Party who was like, hey, wait a minute. Didn't we just say, like, we don't do Supreme Court confirmations in the last year of the election year for a presidential year, right? Because, like, there's still some chunk of that electorate that remembers things and has some dignity, right? So, like, when McConnell's like, no, we're going to do this and we're not even going to hesitate about it, like, that little chunk in the public data was like, I don't know about that, you know? And so they had to spend some time on Fox normalizing it for these people. Like, no, we're doing it. Everyone's on board. There's no doubt. There's no qualms. We're all doing it. And after a bit of delay from these elite signals, because, like, the way public opinion works is that elites, you know, public opinion leaders, people like you and me, politicians, send signals to the public, and the public adopts, basically, they adjust their opinion based on those signals, which is, you know, obviously not how people think of public opinion, but that's how it works, right? Mm-hmm. And so after a couple of weeks of that, the public's like, you know, all those reluctant Republicans basically fell in line. They're like, oh, okay, we're having this confirmation, and there's nothing abnormal about it at all. Because you'll notice Republicans don't ever talk about it, right? They don't talk about how they did this thing to Merrick Garland. You know, Senator Harris never even freaking mentioned it in the VP debate, right? And so, like, it's been accepted. That's what's happening now in this Republican caucus. Now they're going to try to get Republican voters to basically socialize to accept a Democratic coup.
Well, after he said democracy isn't the objective, which he's basically saying he doesn't like democracy, he followed it up with the words liberty, peace, and prosperity, and, you know, and the flourishing human condition. And those are all things that everybody can get behind. Yes, liberty, peace, prosperity, flourish. And Jason Stanley, the philosopher who wrote the book How Propaganda Works, he wrote, yeah. And I'm going to quote this because I thought it was very interesting after I heard what Mike Lee said. He said, the most basic problem for democracy rated by propaganda is the possibility that the vocabulary of liberal democracy is used to mask an undemocratic reality. And using the words liberty and peace and prosperity, I thought fit right into that.
Yep. Oh, my gosh, yes. No, I mean, keep in mind, none of this shit would be... I can't say that word, sorry.
No, we can't say four-letter words.
None of this stuff would be possible. None of this stuff would be possible if they didn't have Fox News and, like, right-wing propaganda networks, right? Because it's so heavily reliant on being able to control information flow to their third of the country. And if you go in and you talk to Republicans, they have a whole different reality that they live in, right? And under that reality, Bill Barr is not an institution breaker. He's not a norm and rule of law and institution destroyer. He's actually there, basically returning our institutions to their, you know, to integrity after they'd been sullied by Obama, right? And this is something that, like, you know, every Republican will give you chapter and verse from the very top to the bottom. And, you know, it's you can hear it if you listen to any of the Senate or House hearings. You'll hear it in the way that these Republican legislators do their question testimony, question and answer, witness testimony. They, in their mind, they're the ones that are on, like, the side of righteousness, okay? So, like, and when you think about it that way, like, what's coming, what they're going to do, it's just completely justified. If you think that the other side has usurped democracy, that they have abused the rule of law, that they have, you know, done all of these perversions in the FBI and the CIA and the Justice Department, and you've been riding the ship, right? Then, you know, then you go into this election, right? And you can hear Bill Barr kind of, you know, laying this out for them. Oh, these ballots that are going to come in through the mail, these are not American votes, right? These are other things. They are, of course, votes from Americans, but he is preparing this perception that these are not votes from Americans. They're votes from foreign adversaries, votes from illegal aliens, or whatever they are. They're not votes from Americans, and therefore it becomes imperative that they not count them, right? And so, like, you can see very easily when you have that Fox News media propaganda, they don't have any access or seek out any information that counters that they could easily find themselves in a position where they're supporting an undemocratic coup.
Well, I've been reading Brian Stelter's new book, Hoax, and he talks about, he interviewed anchors and reporters inside Fox who were appalled by Trump's gradual takeover of the network. And they said that management encouraged pro-Trump propaganda and discouraged real reporting. So he calls it the Trumpification of Fox and the Foxification of America. And that also terrifies me about how we get, you know, poke holes into the armor that they've surrounded themselves with. But
if we survive the triage crisis of get through this election and remove Trump and Barr from power, because yeah, it really is this tandem problem. I mean, Barr is really, as he's Trump is more dangerous because he's president, but Barr is more dangerous because he's Barr, right?
Right, right, and has a lot of power there. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes, you know. But if we get through that, like, then the very next thing is, like, how do you solve this problem of this right-wing, you know, basically Joseph Goebbels, like, programming of a third of the American electorate.
Right.
And it is a very big problem.
It sure is. And, Rachel, you know, I want to thank you for this conversation. We've just been going lickety-split through all sorts of subjects. I still have, you know, 50% of my questions here. But I just wanted to thank you for this conversation. I also want to thank Be Bold America's program engineer, Emily Donham, and then give another huge thank you to Dr. Rachel Bitticoffer. If you're a political science wonka like I am, please check out her podcast, The Election Whisperer. Next time on Be Bold America, our interview guest will be SiriusXM's Michelangelo Signorelli of the Michelangelo Signorelli Show on Progress 127. This October is the 15th anniversary of the LGBTQ History Month, and Michelangelo will discuss and celebrate the achievements of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender icons. In addition, Michelangelo will discuss what differing political outcomes could occur affecting LGBTQ Americans if Joseph Biden wins the presidential election, or if Donald Trump remains in the Oval Office. So please join me on Sunday, October 25th at 5 p.m. to learn about LGBTQ icons and the presidential election outcomes. Want to listen to a program later? Find the Be Bold America podcast on KSQD's website or subscribe on your favorite platform. You're listening to KSQD Santa Cruz. Many voices, one station. Listen worldwide online at ksqd.org. And stay tuned for Faith Matters with Seth Shapiro. My name is Jill Cody, and thank you for listening to Be Bold America. Until next time, keep, stop, start.